This edition of Meet the Writers was first broadcast on the 20th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin, one of the most important Canadian literary voices in recent history. My guest today won the Booker Prize in 2002 for Life of Pi, which sold over 13 million copies and was translated into 38 languages. The film adaptation received 4 Academy Awards. He's published short stories as well as more novels, and now, after a long break, he's back with a new work. Welcome, Yann Martel. Where have you been? What took you so long? We've all been waiting.
Oh, I always write quite slowly, actually. All my books take about 4 or 5 years. In this case, I've been slowed down by the fact that since my last book came out, I've had 3 more children enter my life. So I have 4 children now. So in a sense, I've been working on 5 novels at the same time. The written one and then the living ones that scurry around me.
Well, let's go back to your own opening chapters. You were actually born in Spain in 1963, but from Canadian parents. So give me the geography, if you like, of your upbringing.
Well, it was an extensive geography. My parents were in Spain because my father was doing a PhD and my mother was also studying, doing a master's. But I was born in Spain, but within 10 days we'd moved to Coimbra in Portugal. And then after a summer there to Alaska, where my father taught at the University of Alaska. So that started a series of moves that continued throughout my childhood, initially because of academia. My father had 2 stints at universities, University of Alaska, the University of Victoria. And then he and then eventually my mother joined the Department of Foreign Affairs, so they became diplomats. And so we moved to various embassies. The first one was Costa Rica in Central America. So I moved around a lot as a child, which is perhaps why there's always trips and foreign locations in my novels.
They feel very, very global. Was there ever a sense that you wouldn't be a writer? I mean, you had various dead-end jobs.
Oh, the longest time there's no sense that I'd be a writer. I think I came to writing relatively late in the sense that the first things that I wrote for myself, I was in my late teens at university. I wrote a terrifically bad play. And then I wrote another incredibly bad play, and then I wrote bad short stories. It was not clear at all to me that I had any future doing it. In fact, the only reason I persisted is obviously I enjoyed doing it, but people can enjoy playing the air guitar, and they never think they're going to actually play the real guitar. But the real reason I continued is I was terrified of the working world. I didn't see in what way I could fit in the working world. I had no skill, no talent. The only thing I really enjoyed doing was writing, and slowly, slowly I got better.
Because you did things like you were a parking attendant.
I was a parking lot attendant. I was a dishwasher. I was a security guard. I worked at my university library at the counter where you take books out. You know, I did Joe jobs, which I quite liked actually because it let my mind wander while my body was allegedly busy. So that was, I guess that was clearly an indication already that I was a bit of a dreamer. And eventually I was lucky I managed to put those dreams on the page.
And your first book was 4 short stories. The protagonist in that, is it you?
Yes and no. I'm not very character driven in my writing, and I'm certainly not autobiographical in intent. So usually it's a fictionalized version of myself. I tend to find narrators who are pleasant and slightly comfortable. You're comfortable being with them so that in a sense you're taking a ride with them, and either Pi or the narrator of my first short stories is someone that you're comfortable being in a car with, like a very friendly taxi driver, and you sit beside him and he drives, but you both look out the window at the same time. So I'd rather take an ordinary person and put him in extraordinary circumstances than have an extraordinary narrator in, you know, surrounded by banality. So they're always very thinly autobiographical. What they are, though, is intellectually biographical. Obviously, the books that I write reflect a certain interest I have on a particular subject matter. So to my mind, very clearly, my first book, the collection of short stories, The Facts Behind the Helsinki Rock Amadeus, was a story about stories. How do stories work? What can you do with them? What is their purpose? How do they come together? Clearly, I was experimenting in what a story could be while I was writing those stories.
And it was an experiment you continue to do even now. Self, your first full-length book, received mixed reviews. What do you think, looking back on it now?
Well, as you say, it's an experiment. All my books are experiments, and sometimes experiments work for some readers and they don't work for others. In the case of Self, I was interested in exploring gender identity and sexual orientation identity. So it's the story of a young man who, while he's backpacking in Portugal, overnight transforms into a woman. She's a woman for 7 years and then metamorphosizes again into a man. So I was interested in looking at what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, to the extent that we're aware of it, to the extent that we self-consciously say, I'm doing this because I'm a woman or because I'm a man. And I was also interested in looking at a gender orientation. So the character is a man, a heterosexual young man, becomes a woman, and in her first years as a woman, she's still thinking. There's still the flavor of her male heterosexuality in her mind, so she's still attracted to women. But then very slowly she drifts towards conventional female heterosexuality, i.e. an attraction to men. And so the first time she kisses a man, the first thought that pops into her head is, I'm gay. Even though from the external perspective, they're just two heterosexuals, a boy kissing a girl. So I was also exploring the idea that our bodies are an environment, that we adapt to our own bodies, just as the way we adapt to our external environment, that it leads to tendencies that, of course, can be overridden, but nonetheless certain tendencies. So I was exploring that in that story. And it had mixed reviews, I guess, because, interestingly enough, most men are interested in women and most women are interested in men, but they're not interested in being the other. Mm. They want to explore the other, perhaps, live with the other, sleep with the other, but not be the other. So it was a terrain that fewer people were interested in exploring.
And then, of course, came the huge success of Life of Pi, 13 million copies sold, and a major motion picture, 4 Academy Awards, but I think something like 11 nominations. How involved were you with the filming process? How easy is it to let go, to hand over to Ang Lee and say, it's yours?
Oh, very easy, actually. I didn't find any problems with that, because you never get blamed as a writer for the movie that's made based on your book. So if it had been a great movie, I could have said, well, it was based on my book. And if it was a terrible movie, I could have said, well, it's his movie. You know, either way, I wouldn't have lost. And the fact is, I like art in all its expressions, and I like the risks that we take in making art. So I was quite happy to let it go. In fact, I told Ang Lee repeatedly, take liberties, you know, stray from the original to turn it into truly something cinematic. So my involvement was quite minimal. I read 2 early drafts of the screenplay. Ang invited me to the last 2 days of the shoot in Montreal, so there's actually a small scene. I have a small cameo in it. I'm sitting on a bench across a pond in between Adult Pie and the author. So it was a sideshow. It was a fun sideshow. I mean, I'm a writer. I'm comfortable with the language of words, and I was the first person surprised at the success of Life of Pi. I certainly didn't expect it.
Mm. It won the Booker Prize and has gone on, of course, to sell and sell. It's still selling today. How do you think that remuneration changes output? You talk about taking risks, and of course, with a financial cushion, that must be a lot easier.
Yes, but I'm always amazed at what rich people do. Because I don't do it. I find I'm happy that I have enough money that I don't have to worry about surviving or my children will fall into need. But beyond a certain amount, it's irrelevant to me. It has nothing to do. I mean, it really is the case that money doesn't buy you love. It's funny, I remember reading about Freddie Mercury, the lead singer of Queen. He was a really unhappy man. And I realize now that of course he was, because whether he was rich or famous, poor or wealthy, he had issues and he had difficulties, and wealth and fame didn't change anything at all. So the incredible success of Life of Pi is just that, the success of Life of Pi. In a sense, that's the book. I'm just the writer. I quietly live in a place called Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, in the middle of nowhere. And whatever strengths I had as a writer continue. You know, I quite like my ideas. I'm quite happy with the ideas that I tell myself and how I put them down on the page. I'm not that confident about my strength as an actual writer of words, of sentences, but I still enjoy it. All those qualities and faults continue whether you've had a success or not. And every new book is a new challenge that tests your abilities to pull a novel off. So I'm eternally thankful for the success of Life of Pi, which to me is really measured not by the sales or the money or the Oscars or the Booker, but by the connection I've made with readers, complete strangers from different cultures who reach out to me with letters, but also at lineups and signings who, bend down and say, I have a question for you or a little story for you. And it's amazing to what extent they take on this book, they take on its metaphors. And that's really the success of art, is when it has nothing to do with the numbers. So for example, the subsequent book, speaking of experimentation, Beatrice and Virgil, which was an animal allegory on the Holocaust, once again, greatly divided critics. It doesn't matter to me that it sold less than Life of Pi. It still made connections with some people. And even those who hated it if they've read it, I'm quite happy that they hated it. That was their reaction. That's what they brought to it. It reflects as much them and their view of the world, and specifically of the Holocaust, as it does reflect the book itself.
Well, interesting talking about that book, because as you say, you've been criticised as a non-Jewish author writing about the Holocaust. And I wondered what your opinion was on borrowed narrative, or what some might call, I suppose, cultural appropriation.
Or voice appropriation. Well, it's interesting how you never hear people who write about war being criticized for not being non-combatants. We take on war incredibly comfortably. People that talk about war from the most reasoned and heartfelt way to the most nonsensical, stupid way. And that's the way it should be. We should be comfortable talking about war, about conflict. Interesting how we don't feel that comfort level about the Holocaust. We feel that you can take liberties only, first of all, if you're Jewish. If you're a Jewish survivor, you're pretty well entitled to say what you want. But the further you stray away from the historical figures involved in the tragedy, especially in the victim sides of the tragedies, the more there's a sort of quiet censorship. So irony can do remarkable things for keeping feelings alive.
At one point in your new book, you talk about how a story is like a wedding, and that one is led down one grand corridor after another, eventually to the main ballroom. And I wonder if that reflects your own writing process.
Absolutely. I've become aware that what you write on the page is only half of a sentence, and the other half is completed by the reader, who brings something of his or her imagination. And it's together, as you just said, like a wedding, that there's this imaginative consummation, and that's when it really comes alive. Which is why it's always fascinating to me. You have two people who read the exact same book will have diametrical opposite reactions. And that's why I love, it's always fascinating talking to readers, see what they brought to my book. It's amazing to me how so quickly author intent, and obviously in every book that I've written, I have a number of intents, things that I'm aware of that I'm trying to do, how quickly that is overtaken by reader reception, by how the reader receives it, what she or he brings to it, and brings it in ways that I never thought of. And the clearest example so far, because it's the one where it happened the most often, was Life of Pi, where people were bringing interpretations and seeing things that I didn't see at all, but fit very nicely. Mm-hmm. I'll just give you one very obvious, very minor one. Pi is at sea for 227 days. That's a prime number, a number that's divisible only by itself or by one. And my intent there was that since I'm telling two different stories, I wanted you to believe one or the other entirely. I wanted it to be indivisible. That was the idea in my mind. Would anyone get it? Some readers said, oh, it's a prime number. And did they go further than that? I'm not sure. But finally, one day, a reader said to me, you know what? 227, 22 divided by 7, that's pi, approximately. And I never thought of that. He thought that was my intent, but it wasn't. It was just, it fit somehow, that I happened to choose that prime number and it happens to represent pi. So these are things, insights that readers had, and there's a whole lot of other ones, much sort of deeper in terms of the interpretations of the story, that people brought to me that I just never occurred to me. And I love that. That's how a story should work.
One man famously hasn't read your books, or indeed many other books at all, and he's the previous Canadian leader, Stephen Harper. Tell me about your relationship, or non-relationship as it was, with him.
It was a chilly one. Stephen Harper was Prime Minister of Canada for 10 years, and he's one of these narrow ideologues who wants to simplify the world. Instead of seeing the world as it is, and then trying to nudge it in one direction or another, he first of all sees how the world wants to be, and he imposes it on the world, with a degree of calculation and coldness that I think is antithetical to the way democracies should work. Of course, there has to be cold choices made, but they have to be made in a spirit of openness and dialogue. And here was a man who was not open, neither in his mind nor in his capacity for dialogue. And I also happened to notice, it became quite clear, that he's a man who doesn't read. I think he's one of these men, and it's more typical of men than of women, who stopped reading probably in his early 20s. He's obviously a very bright man, but I think in his early 20s, he came to the conclusion that fiction isn't real, and therefore its truth must be relative, and therefore stopped reading fiction and probably just started reading nonfiction, histories, biographies. And there's nothing wrong with histories and biographies, of course, but in defense of fiction, fiction goes further than nonfiction can go. We go with our empathetic imagination, where you cannot go with the facts of histories, even with the most insightful interpretations. And nothing can do it like fiction can do it. And so if you fail to read, if you never read fiction or poetry or plays, I mean fiction broadly, I'm puzzled as to how someone can know the human condition. To me, there's only two ways of knowing who we are, and that is either by reading or by traveling, which to me are very equivalent activities. Traveling the world, traveling to Turkey is like reading a book. How can you know the human condition if you don't read, especially if you're a leader? If you don't read and you just have a little job, that doesn't matter particularly. But if you're a leader of a nation of 35 million, people, and you've never read and never traveled, which applies to Stephen Harper, he'd never been to Europe, for example, before he became prime minister, how can you rule us? How can you know what our dreams are, where we must go, if you don't have dreams yourself? So I'm just highly suspicious of powerful people who don't read. And, you know, the shocking contrast is Barack Obama, out of the blue, wrote me a little note about Life of Pi, which he'd read with his daughter, and they loved it, so he bothered himself to write me a note out of the blue. So that's one letter from a foreign head of state, whereas my own prime minister, to whom I'd sent 101 books and 101 letters, never replied to me.
Let's move on now to your new book, The High Mountains of Portugal, with the definite article there, unlike Life of Pi, which does not.
Thank you for noting that.
Your publisher, Canongate, says it takes the reader on a road trip through Portugal in the last century and through the human soul. Now, the High Mountains of Portugal, not a geographical feature, but as you put it, an act of national vanity.
Yes, because there's an area in northeast Portugal called Trás os Montes, which means beyond or behind the mountains, and there are no mountains. It's an act of storytelling, naming that landscape that way. That's what toponymy is. When you name places, we name them to make us feel at home with them. And so this was a particular, it's an egregious example of naming something that isn't, that doesn't exist. So it struck me that first time I visited Portugal when I was 19 or 20, how toponymy is an act of storytelling. So in this particular case, in this novel, the novel The High Mountains of Portugal, as two characters observe, there are no high mountains. So in a sense, these are mental mountains. These are mountains of the soul, magic mountains that must be climbed by the characters in their own hearts, in their own minds.
And there are three characters, a young man in Lisbon in 1904 who discovers an old journal, a Portuguese pathologist 35 years later who finds himself at the centre of a murder mystery, and a Canadian senator 50 years on who's grieving the loss of his wife. Now, none of them ostensibly are you, but the dedication is interesting because it's to your wife and children, and it says, the story of my life.
I think what we do as we are living, and this applies to us as human beings, is we weave a story. And those stories are based on facts to some extent. You know, when we were born, to whom we were born, where we live, the language we are given. These are facts you can't avoid. But that's just the ground upon which we build the edifice of our lives. Very quickly, we start interpreting those facts, who we are, why we are, what we are. That's all, subjectivity plays such an important role, which is why, going back to the defense of fiction, fiction isn't just an entertainment and way of learning, it's also a way of living. We weave fictions into our lives and they become true. Even if they are not real, they become true. That's the essence of religious thinking. An act of faith is an act of believing in something for which you have no proof, but it feels true to you. That is a fiction, a grand fiction, a life-altering fiction, a cosmos-altering fiction. And the same thing with, you know, with secular art. We read books that really, truly, profoundly change us. Every one of us, I think, has read a book in our youth that changes our direction in life. So in a sense, fiction has changed us, has changed who we are. We weave the two together, and I think we have to be aware of that. An awareness of storytelling, I think, leads us to a greater adaptability to creating our lives.
You pose the question, what does suffering do to a man? Does he understand more as a result of suffering? Do you believe that?
Well, I believe in the question. I mean, I think the beginning of art and the beginning of religion is rooted in suffering. Someone who is entirely happy has no reason to change, has no reason to grow, has no reason to evolve. It's small and great acts of suffering that redirect us because they push us to question ourselves and to become something different. They demand a reinterpretation of things, and the capacity to do that will make a suffering possible. So in each of the stories, in each of the three parts of this novel, I posit someone who has suffered, and then I want to ask, where do we go from there? What do we do with that suffering? Now, some people, nothing happens with their suffering. I remember when I was doing my research on the Holocaust for Beatrice and Virgil, a testimony of one victim of the Holocaust, one of the camps, who said, you know, I didn't learn anything from my suffering. It just diminished me. It hurt a lot. It didn't give me any great wisdom. It just diminished me. It beat me down. It humiliated me. It terrified me. It starved me. He wasn't, as a result of it, some Hindu wise man on top of a mountain. You know, he would just say, never again. He'd express himself in certain cliched phrases of never again, you know, love, love, love. It was these certain cliches because that's all he could reach up for. So suffering sometimes can be stultifying, but as a society and as enlightened individuals, you want to try to make something of it. That's the very foundation of Christianity, the idea that suffering can improve you, that you have to improve yourself through suffering, because that, in a sense, the point of it, otherwise it defeats you and nothing comes of it. And that's a pity.
The first part of the book, Homeless, ends with the observation, we are risen apes, not fallen angels. And that comes up again later in the work. It's a quote from Robert Ardrey. The miracle of man is not how far he has sunk, but how magnificently he's risen.
Yeah, I deliberately quoted him in the first part, uncredited, and I credit him in the second part, because, you know, and from the perspective of the first part, it is a negative in terms of religion. There are no fallen angels, we're risen apes. We are the results of extraordinary evolutionary forces that have nothing to do with any greater reality. But in the second, in the last part of the novel, I re-quote that one from a different perspective, in the sense that risen apes are nonetheless something extraordinary that could be part of a greater plan. My interest here, I mean, you write about things that a writer writes about where his curiosity leads him, and I've become increasingly interested in this, that very curious phenomenon called faith, that ability to believe in something for which you have no verifiable, reproducible proof. It's a very odd, very human act, and it intrigues me, and I find there are ways of faith, there are ways to always have faith, and including with evolution, with Darwinian evolution, that in a sense is part of a narrative. It's an unusual narrative, not an expected one, but it can be still part of that narrative. So I think that quote from Robert Ardrey can go both ways. Mm. It can actually, in fact, instead of downgrading a religion, could rise up a creation.
Faith, of course, runs the whole way through the book and indeed through all of your work. I just wonder, the second part of the book, Homeward, there's the most wonderful explanation of how the life of Jesus is like a murder mystery, more specifically, Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie mystery. Just run that by us.
Yeah, I had this, I observed how the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie and the Jesus event of 2,000 years ago have an extraordinary number of similarities. Just for example, the role of the witness. In any murder mystery, there are witnesses that are key in the unraveling of the story. Same thing with the story of Jesus. The witnesses, i.e. the four evangelists, played a key role. They're unreliable then. Witnesses are unreliable in Agatha Christie's murder mysteries. The fact that we always forget who the victimizers are in an Agatha Christie murder mystery, it's amazing how you read them in the grip of compulsion and you're delighted to find who did it, and it's so extraordinarily ingenious on her part, and then so quickly we forget who did it. Mm. So you have to reread the book, you know, two-thirds of it to find out, oh right, it's this person who did it. Same thing with the Jesus event. We know who the victim is, Jesus of Nazareth. It's amazing how people don't remember or don't think about who did it. Mm. Now it's inherent in the narrative of Jesus now that who specifically did it was not important, but it's interesting, once again, they match. So there's a lot of similarities, and I think what happens is they reproduce something on Agatha Christie's part unwittingly. Both of them talk about death in a way that is palatable. One by dint of being entertaining, Agatha Christie, and the other by dint of resurrecting. In both cases, they talk about death in the way that we find acceptable. Whereas before that, in earlier religions like Judaism, which is a very earthbound, concerned about the here and now and how do we live properly, and not so concerned about the afterlife, is not concerned with death as much. Christianity, having started with an apocalyptic Jew, is very focused on death. Mm. And so he brings it closer to it, but he makes it palatable because he resurrects. Whereas in Agatha Christie's case, in a much more secular age, she talks about it, and we do feel we need to talk about death, but we're uncomfortable with it. She makes it comfortable by making it so marvelously entertaining, and yet it takes place in a moral framework. Mm. Murder mysteries are inherently moral. Someone is murdered, you have to find the murderer. There's no nihilism in Agatha Christie. So they sort of echoed each other, and I just found that it was a really fun section to write, actually, the observation of how many similarities there are between the Gospels and her murder mysteries.
Yeah, fun to read. The final part of the book, Home, has a lot of departures, leaving home, leaving partners, ultimately leaving life. Now, Peter's parents leave Portugal when he's a small child, and they turn their back on their origins. And you have a wonderful phrase for that, identity engineering.
Hmm. Well, I think that's quite common with immigrants, in a sense that happened slightly unwittingly with me. My mother tongue is French. My parents are Quebecois. I speak French with them. I also lived 10 years in France. But the happenstance of life led me to always go to school in English, which is why I write in English, while still occasionally committing Gallicisms. I always see grapes and I call them raisins. because of raisin in French. So I do some small mistakes like that, which my partner always delights in pointing out. So in a sense, my identity was engineered, but it could be done very successfully, of course. Immigrants fit marvelously in other languages and other cultures and become themselves while being different from what they were, you know, what their original template was.
Many creatures, of course, appear in each part of the book and indeed in all of your work. Fleas, interestingly, a lot of the way through this book, I notice. But finally, the Iberian rhinoceros. Now, I know that this is a creature that you've long had a fascination with. In fact, wasn't Richard Parker originally going to be a rhino?
Yeah, the main animal character in Life of Pi was initially going to be a rhinoceros, because most people, everyone knows what a rhino is, but they actually know very little about it. You know, which ones has two horns, which one has one, what do they eat, what are their social habits, are they gregarious or solitary animals? So they're very useful for storytelling, and I couldn't use them in Life of Pi because they're herbivores, so I finally stuck them in this book.
So finally, these three story tributaries come together as a sort of a mighty river of a book about grief and love and how quickly we revert to our baser selves and how hard it is to stay human and stay civilized and in the face of great loss. And I get the feeling that perhaps you think that we'd be better off as animals.
Well, there's a certain quality we gain from them. First of all, animals are not consumers. They're not materialistic animals. There's an ability to be in the moment, which is what really strikes me about animals, which is why I use them in these novels that have a sort of a religious context or faith subtext from a secular perspective, in that, you know, holy figures and animals both live in the present moment, have a strong sense of presence. They echo each other. So yes, I think we should become both more godlike and more animal-like, whatever that means. In some ways, both diminish and augment our humanity by doing that. There is something we learn both from gods, obviously, any gods from any religion, whatever, but also from animals. There is, you know, the most obvious one is that animals live in equilibrium with their environment. They don't systematically destroy the environment the way we do, because if they do, they die. And then, you know, they come back, but it's hard. So they have an ability to live in equilibrium, which we don't. With our aggressive intelligence, we're destroying the planet. So even just on a basic level like that, but also their ability to forget. You know, animals don't bear grudges. This ability to live in the present moment, which, you know, the foundation of, you know, entire religions, Buddhism is all about living in the present moment and making the most of it. So in a sense, it's Judaism, living in the moment now and making the best moral choices in the here and now. There's something we gain from that. And we gain that, in a sense, just by staring at your pet dog and your pet cat. We do have something to learn from them. Their ability to relax, their ability to be in touch with their environment, to breathe the fresh air, to look up at the sky, to live. There's something we learn from them. And also, frankly, in a sense, we live in a wider democracy than a human democracy. This is a planet, and in a sense, every single creature on it is a citizen with some right to a vote, and we shouldn't ignore entirely their votes the way we have been for, well, since the advent of modernity, frankly. We've been disregarding animal creatures all the time, either systematically slaughtering them in our slaughterhouses to cater to our gratuitous hunger, or destroying their environment just by neglect.
Do you have a pet?
I have a little pet Havanese. I love her. She's a little cute little dog named Bamboo. The kids love her. I love her too, actually.
The High Mountains of Portugal by Yann Martel is published by Canongate. It's out now and it's available everywhere, everywhere that sells books. Thank you.
Thank you, Georgina.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Join us again to listen live at the same time next week. If you'd like to hear the show again, or indeed any of the others in the series, you can download it from SoundCloud, iTunes, or the Monocle website or app. And if you subscribe to one of those channels for free, you'll never miss an episode. You can also find out more details in the culture section of Monocle magazine. Very many thanks to Yann Martel, to Claire Urban for production, and Hong Jin Wong for research. And of course to you for listening. I'm Georgina Godwin, goodbye.